Welcome to Women on the Line, Community Radio's National Women's Current Affairs program, produced at 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne and broadcast on the Community Radio Network. I'm Rachel Buongiorno. On this week's show, we meet Dawati Dazir, a Mambo Asagwe or High Priest in Haitian Voodoo who lives in New York. Dawati Dazir is a passionate advocate of voodoo and dedicates much of her time to fostering a greater understanding of voodoo's religious and cultural practices, as well as connecting people of African descent with their spiritual traditions. Her work also aims to dispel the myths that plague the voodoo religion, including the Hollywood-invented racist mythologies of zombies and pins and dolls that were popularized throughout the 20th century to justify colonial occupations of Haiti.
My name is Dawati Dazir, Mambo Dawati Dazir. I am a high priest in Haitian voodoo. My title is Mambo Asogwe, which means the keeper of the medicinal packet. I am a writer and a scholar, a curator and a mom. Our role as priests is multifold. It's no different from what a rabbi or a pastor or, or a father does in any other tradition. Our role as priests is to help people heal. First and foremost, it isn't about preaching and converting them, but it is definitely about enabling healing, spiritual, social healing, as well as physical healing when people are ill. Because voodoo is an eco-theological religion, meaning that its principles, its tenets are tied into the earth, it's tied to the four movements of the sun, it's tied to the cycle of life and death. So the process of constantly recycling our energies is something that is emphasized in the tradition. And so the role of priests, especially in Asogwe, would be to help recycle and facilitate recycling these energies and bringing positive and healing energies into our world. Tonight, we're in the temple, the home temple of Nougan in New Jersey, in Passaic, New Jersey, and we're going to be celebrating Gede. Gede represents the ancestors. They are the Lwa, the spiritual forces of those who came before us. And so the ceremony is acknowledging the role of the dead, the role of our ancestors in not only providing the opportunity for those of us who are the living, part of Voodoo's covenant is the relationship, the communities that are honored and respected amongst those of us on this plane. That relationship is tied and connected to the communities that preceded us. So we honor it and respect those who are among us, and visible and living, and we honor and respect those who have come before us. Ceremonies are executed through song, through music, through prayer, through dance. What you'll see, it's referred to as a fete, and it really is almost like that, what it suggests. How we celebrate and honor ourselves and our notions of God and the Lwa is through all aspects of our being. It's not necessarily through a book. Our connections with God are more vibrant. So, yes, we'll pray, you'll hear prayers, but for the most part we're singing, because the singing is a manifestation of prayer. The singing allows a certain kind of vibration to enter into the universe and allows divine energy to transmit itself that way. The music, the drumming, allows that, the voice of what is divine and what is best within us to convey itself over longer distances. The drumming isn't just musical in the sense that there's no message or text being conveyed. I mean, each drum rhythm represents a specific dwa or specific songs for dwa, but because of the polyphonic nature of African sensibilities, the drums themselves are singing. They're talking. They're echoing, they're repeating, they're underscoring, and paraphrasing what we are singing. They are a form of prayer. Our dances are a form of prayer. They're specific dances for specific musical rhythms that are accompany specific dwa. So, in other words, our traditions are highly codified. The colors that we wear represent specific dwa. The music that accompanies it represents a specific dwa. My role as a priest is one that is a healer, not just in terms of administering, you know, medicinal herbs to people who might be ill that way, but also it's evolved into one that speaks to solving or resolving social ruptures and historical ruptures. Because I'm a human rights activist, and in my human rights work, part of what I try to get people within not only the Haitian community, the Voodoo community, the Afro-Atlantic community as a whole, but our societies in general, is to understand the importance and the significance of African epistemologies and African spiritual thought and practice, its importance, its cultural patrimony, how it's helped shaped world thought for that matter. And to encourage people to understand that it is okay to be an African descendant and to embrace your Africanness. Because we live in a world as a result of colonialism and the transatlantic slave trade. In some ways, we can describe the historical experience of African descendants, particularly in the Afro-Atlantic world, in the Americas, as one that our experience vis-a-vis the West, vis-a-vis the global North, has been about mnemonic erasure. It's been about erasing our culture, erasing our memory, erasing our sense of self. And I see my role as a human rights activist and as a Mambo Asogo as one that is to help heal that, to repair that gap, to help sort of literally conjure memory. So that our sense of self and sense of place is restored. Because it's when that occurs that the process of reparations, spiritual reparations, can begin. When one is considered a person without a history, one is not deemed a human being. And so I'm interested in playing the role that my ancestors played in, and playing the role that the leaders of the Haitian Revolution, which included women, played, which is to help reinstantiate our humanity, to make it clear that we are fully realized beings with a past, with genius, with vision, with ingenuity. And we can only know what that is if we go back to the source. And in this case, the source is to Mother Africa. One of the ways I'm doing that is the work that I'm doing with the UN Subcommittee Against Racism and the U.S. Human Rights Network and my own organization, the DDPA Watch Group. The International Decade for People of African Descent starts in January 2015 and ends in December of 2024. One of the critical things that has... There's several things that have to happen. With the International Decade, the mechanisms that had been proposed at the World Conference Against Racism in 2001 in Durban, South Africa, which urged states to eliminate racism, racial discrimination, and xenophobia, mechanisms that address the plight of women, the plight of youth, and others who are considered minorities in their communities, those mechanisms have to be put in place so that we do not live in a society or societies that continue to destroy themselves by destroying those whom they do not think are human. We are trying to establish a permanent forum for people of African descent as a majority group at the UN, because there is still this perception that we are quote-unquote minorities, but we are not. We're not. Globally, we're not. And to the extent that one is deemed and labeled a minority, people tend to think, especially in non-democratic states, that we are voiceless and invisible. So creating a permanent forum is about altering that. We are also trying to seek reparations, not just financial reparations and economic ones, but scientific reparations, social reparations, reparations around education, all of the kind of disparities that exist that create this enormous gap between those who have and those who have not. Especially amongst African descendants, we're trying to close those gaps so that poverty isn't informing our lives, so that we don't stay in this place of not having, of not having space. And that space is material in its being. It's housing related. That space is intellectual in terms of not seeing our histories documented in school books. That space is gender based in terms of the oppression and sustained and enforced invisibility of African descendant women, especially in Latin America, and then youth in general and male youth in particular. So these are some of the things that we're trying to alter in the during the course of the international decade. And for myself in particular, and I'm pulling together attorneys and other human rights attorneys and other people in the spiritual community so that our traditions of voodoo, of candomblé, of Palo Mayombe, of Arara, of Shango Baptist, of Santeria, all of these African-based traditions are still, shockingly enough, outlawed even in our own countries. You know, following the earthquake of 2010 in Haiti, the Haitian constitution was changed in 2012 to outlaw voodoo. Voodoo, that is not just a religion, but it's a discipline, it's a way of life. How do you outlaw your own culture? How do you do that? But apparently the donor community, I would say coerced then President Préval to agree to this, and then had the current president, Marsili, essentially sign away our rights of sovereignty in that case. In Jamaica, the African religion of Obeah is still outlawed. How can somebody's religion be outlawed? If we were Jewish, we would say, this is the worst form of anti-Semitism. So this is the worst form of Afrophobia, this fear of African culture, people, sensibilities. And so we're trying to have that turned around. And I have to tell you, there's a historical reason why these traditions have been outlawed. It's because they're tied into resistance. They're tied into our historical resistance to all the revolutions, to all the revolts, to all the acts of marronnage, of seeking freedom that Africans have had. Not even the moment we arrived here, but the moment we were enshackled on the continent itself. Voodoo has been vilified. It's been put down as, you know, zombies and witchcraft and all sorts of horrific things that actually have nothing to do with the religion, because it was intended to, in some ways, deflate the African imagination. It was intended to, again, to erase the African imagination, especially the African radical imagination. And our struggle centuries later is still in place. And so when I talk about my role as a voodoo priest isn't to give love baths. There are plenty of other people who can do that. My role is to help us love ourselves and each other, and in many ways take this notion of the revolution and help facilitate another incarnation of it, one that will in fact result in this just world that our leaders had for us.
And on community radio stations right around Australia, you're listening to Women on the Line. Over the last 6 months, the US has seen a wave of protests over the deaths of Michael Brown and Eric Garner, two unarmed black men killed by white police officers. The shootings and subsequent no indictments for the police officers have prompted a growing movement of communities who are calling for an end to police brutality and racial profiling, greater accountability, and the need to systematically combat structural racism in the US. One of the single largest protests in this movement took place in New York City on December 15th, where between 50 and 60,000 people came out. I went along to the Millions March to speak with some of the protesters.
My name is Osana Bolger, and the only thing that I really have to say on this march is that it's something that means a lot to me, and I think that people should really be out here protesting for what they believe in. And I think that this is really going to be a great protest, and you know, it's going to be productive. This is a sign, and it says the power of the people is stronger than the people of the power. And on the other side, it says Mike and Trayvon and Steven and your son, meaning that anything can happen at any moment, so you need to take a stand.
I'm Avanti and I'm 12. I came out today because I think it's important that we all come together to prove a point, especially one that's been such a problem over the years. I hope that this will become something that people are more aware of and that people understand more, because I think that a huge problem when it comes to racism is ignorance, and it's important that people know what is going on in their country.
My name is Kimberly Crenshaw. I teach law at Columbia, and I run an organization called the African American Policy Forum. I'm out here because injustice that's not spoken and resisted is injustice that will continue. There's been injustice with respect to the criminal justice system and black people since we've been here. It's reached a level now that the contradiction is so great, when you can actually see people being lynched on video and there's no indictment. If we continue and allow that to happen, it sends a message that that's acceptable, and it's just not acceptable. First of all, the criminal injustice system needs to be fundamentally transformed. We can start with the basic notion that those who are responsible for prosecuting police officers shouldn't be the same people who work with them every other day. So we've seen the abuses of the prosecutorial system both here and in Ferguson, when prosecutors have essentially set the system up so that there is no indictment. Everybody who knows anything about indictments knows that you don't do what either of these prosecutors do if you really want an indictment. So this is an opportunity that we can see clearly how the system is actually failing us, how people are using the system to do injustice. So the first thing is setting up a special prosecutor rule everywhere where there's a police-involved shooting. We take it out of the political process as much as possible. And then there are a range of other reforms that have been called for, having to do with body-worn cameras, which is important but not enough, having to do with stronger community review, having to do with more more limitations on the kinds of encounters that police can even have with ordinary citizens. So there are a lot of basic reforms. But more broadly, there has to be just social economic reform. And I think this moment has broadened the frame of what's on the table. Well, I think the first thing is to be able to say that there is racial injustice in the United States. And I think one of the shocking things that we're starting to see now is just how much denial there really was about that matter. I think for the last 8 years, folks have come together under this idea that the best way to handle race is to rise above it. That's been sort of the language of post-racialism. And even if people didn't believe racism wasn't around, still the idea was, well, the best thing to do is just try to, you know, go forward as though race doesn't exist, and that will make it not exist. I think now people are seeing the deep, deep racist underbelly of what has been allowed to go unremarked. When people make a comment to say the effect that, well, black people bring the killings on themselves, when Eric Garner is framed as aggressive because he's upset that the police, you know, are harassing him, then many, many white people will say, well, he shouldn't have done that. That's when you actually see that not talking about race was not the solution. It was not the solution. It allowed a certain kind of racism to actually grow uncontested. So I think the first and most important thing is that this is a moment where post-racialism is dead. It's over with. And so now we have to move to the real hard work of not just conversing about race, but actually being able to name racism, to name racial power, to show where it is. And then we have the struggle over what we do to dismantle it. Young people are really pushing it. They're taking this to the street. And that's what made the civil rights movement as significant. A lot of people focus on the leadership, but the folks who were really moving it were the young people in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. They were the people in the Panthers. They were the ones that were saying, we will not go back to business as usual until something happens. And that's the energy, I think, that we're seeing here. The young people are organizing this. I think the other thing is that social media and the 24-hour news cycle makes it harder for this to go away. And that, I think, is one of the things that people struggled to maintain in the civil rights movement. They had to hope that the New York Times would put a picture on the front page. Now we have our own front pages everywhere, and it's making the issue right in people's faces, and it cannot go away without some kind of response. And the other important thing about this movement is that women are at the center of the organizing. The only challenge is to make sure that women are at the center of the conversation about how police violence is actually working. So we're bringing to the fore the fact that women, as well as men, cis and trans people, queer people, are also victims of police violence. It's important that we have that broader picture of Black Lives Matter.
Monique Williams, Brooklyn, New York. Tired of racism, and it's a system that continues to go on daily in this country. And now only because of these mainstream murders that have reached the news are people seeing what time it is. But it's been going on. It never stopped since the civil rights movement. And it's still a work in progress to today. So that's why I'm here. Well, I have a sign that says, stop saying you're colorblind. That's why we're here again.
My name is Eva Lynch. I'm from Brooklyn, New York.
The laws change.
The laws change, and we can live together as one. You know, everybody have the same rights. We want rights for everyone. You know, no one has to be murdered. Whether it's the color of your skin, no one has to be murdered.
My name is Marlene Dooley. I'm from South Africa. I came here during this South African uprising, because I was labeled a political agitator there. To be a political agitator, you can say the water tastes bad, and that's when they lock you up. And I was a school teacher there, and I was detained in and out all the time. And at that time, I was fearing for the welfare of my children, because I had two children at that time, 7 and 10. And then I fled South Africa via Botswana and via Rhodesia. That time was Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. I ended up in the United States, and I became a teacher now, a high school teacher. I come out on everything that is injustice. because this is how I feel, that in America, as much as they say it's hard, when you work and you call for justice, things do change a little.
Justice.
I have hope. That's why I'm even wearing my South African hat. I have hope. I really do have hope. Things will change. Especially, you know why I have so much hope? Because most of the people who are doing this are young people. And in South Africa, also, the young people are the one who came out. Young people coming out and says, enough is enough. This is injustice. And they, like I said, they started saying to the parents, don't go to the stores, because 99.99 of the stores in South Africa were owned by whites. Another thing that I always get up when I see something like this, because not only South Africa but the whole world, they went to companies that were doing business with South Africa. They wanted them to divest. And when they divested, it was hitting their pockets. And after hitting their pockets, they then decided Mandela can come out of jail. They should just tell them to stop going to the stores. Hit them in the pocket.
Francesca Ramsey. I'm from South Florida, but I've been in New York for 5 years. My sign says, if you are neutral in times of injustice, you've chosen the side of the oppressor. And it's a quote from Desmond Tutu. And I think it's just really encapsulates why we're here. We're here because we want to change things. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people who are complacent and aren't saying anything. I think it's important for them to know that by not saying something, they've chosen to be okay with what's going on. It's really hard because I don't want to be pessimistic, but at the same time, there are so many times that we've had to protest and so many times that we've had to be out here in March and things haven't changed. So I hope that they start to change, but I am committed to be here and continue to support the movement if things don't change.
And that's all we have time for on today's program. Women on the Line is Community Radio's National Women's Current Affairs program. It's produced and presented by a range of women broadcasters from 3CR in Melbourne and broadcast nationally on the Community Radio Network. We greatly appreciate the financial support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We welcome your comments or thoughts on today's show, so send us an email at womenontheline@hotmail.com. Women on the Line programs can be downloaded from our website, womenontheline.org.au.